Lowe's knows that saving is always top of mind, especially this season. That's why we've picked some great deals for early Black Friday. Get free select DeWalt, Kobalt, or Craftsman tools when you buy a select battery or combo kit. More tools? Why not? Plus, we've got select pre-lit artificial Christmas trees starting at $59.98 because it's never too early to think Christmas. Get Black Friday prices without the crowds. Lowe's, we help. You save. While supplies last, selection varies by location.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
This is continuing coverage of the trial of Karen Reed from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. Now, back to the courtroom.
Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. All parties having anything to do before the Honorable Beverly Cannoni, the Justice of the Superior Court, now sitting in Dedham within and for the Commonwealth. Draw near, give your attendance, and you shall be heard. God save the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. This court is in session. Please be seated.
22-117, the Commonwealth versus Karen Reed.
All right, good morning, counsel. Good morning, jury. Good
morning, jurors.
I need to ask you those three questions. Were you able to follow the instructions and refrain from discussing this case with anyone since we left here on Friday?
Yes.
Everyone said yes and nodded affirmatively. Were you also able to follow the instructions and refrain from doing any independent research or investigation into this case?
Yes.
Everyone said yes and nodded affirmatively. Did anyone happen to see, hear, or read anything about this case since we left on Friday? Everyone said no. Thank you very much. All right, Mr. Jackson?
Good morning. Defense calls Dr. Frank Sheridan.
These are from the voir dire. Those are exhibits from the voir dire.
Wait, this way. Can you just watch your step for me?
Yeah.
You solemnly swear the evidence you give the court and jury in the case now in hand show the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help God.
I do.
Thank you.
Good morning, Doctor.
Good morning.
I'm going to ask you to, when you testify, sir, please speak into the microphone if you can, loud and clear.
Very well.
All right, okay. Thank you.
Is it working?
Good. It should be. All right, thank you. All right, Ms. Little.
Good morning. Can you state your first name and spell your last name? The record is.
My first name is Frank, and the last name is Sheridan, S-H-E-R-I-D-A-N.
And if you can make sure to keep your voice up just because the air conditioner is very loud.
Yeah, I noticed that. Okay.
Dr. Sheridan, what is your profession?
I'm a physician, and my specialty is forensic pathology and neuropathology, but most of my career has been primarily forensic pathology.
What do you currently do for a living?
Nothing. I'm retired.
What role or position of employment did you hold before you retired?
Okay, I was the chief medical examiner for San Bernardino County, California, and I was in that position from 1991 until 2017. That's when I retired from that position, but I stayed on a part-time basis for another few years to help out because the office was understaffed. But a few years ago, 2021 or 22, I've lost track of the time, I finally stopped altogether.
Dr. Sheridan, if you could just pull the microphone a little bit.
I'll put myself closer to it, I guess. Okay, is that better?
Yes.
And Ms. Little, if we need to, just let us know and we'll turn off the air conditioning.
Your Honor, can you describe your educational background for the jury?
Okay, well, I was born and raised in Dublin, Ireland, and I had all my initial education there, including primary school, secondary school, and then pre-medical school at the university I was at was the University College Dublin, Ireland, which is part of the National University of Ireland system. So I did my pre-med and medical school training there. And I graduated from medical school in 1971. Then after that, I did a one-year rotating internship, as it's called, of medicine, surgery, and some psychiatry as well. That was a requirement for all doctors for licensure. So that's basically my initial education. Should I go on with my CV or base or not?
Yes. What did you do after medical school to complete your training?
Well, in the years after medical school, I wasn't in training anymore. I was working in Africa, actually, as a medical officer. And that wasn't training, that was a job. And I was there for 3 years in Central Africa. And I was a general medical officer with various duties that included some teaching, but also seeing patients. So I did that for basically 3 years. I then returned to Ireland, and I spent the next 2 years, we're now talking about, by the way, the years I'm about to mention are 1976 to 78. So I was back in my home country, Ireland, and I spent those 2 years doing research and lecturing in pharmacology. Pharmacology is the study of drugs and how they act in the body. And I did that back at the same university where I had originally trained for medical school. So then in 1978, I came to the United States, initially to the University of Oregon, and I spent the next almost 3 years doing research there and lecturing in the field of genetics. It was during the time I was there that I decided to do forensic pathology. So starting in 1980, let me think for a second, 1982, I then had to start what's called a residency program in pathology. And the first part of that, the first year of that was in Loma Linda University Medical Center in Southern California. I then had to interrupt my residency training and I had to go and work in family practice for a year. This was because I was going through the immigration system of the United States and they required that you, people in my position, work for a year in family practice in a manpower shortage area, as they designated it, an area where there weren't enough doctors. So I did that in a place called Yucca Valley, Y-U-C-C-A Valley, California. But then after that year, I returned to the residency program and the continued on at Loma Linda University Medical Center. And this training was in what's called anatomic pathology, which in a way you can think of it as general pathology. It involved autopsies, it involved surgical pathology, looking at slides from surgery. It involved a few other things as well. And so I was doing that there at Loma Linda. Then from 86 to 88, I went to Los Angeles County, USC, which stands for University of Southern California. So LA County, USC, as it's generally known, for 2 years of training in neuropathology. Neuropathology being disease and injury of the brain, spinal cord, so forth. So that was from 86 to 88. And then in 1988, I went to the coroner's office, as it was then called. It's now a sheriff coroner's office, but at that time it was a coroner's office. And in San Bernardino, I did my 1 year required training in forensic pathology there. When I finished that year, I stayed on at the same office. And then in 1991, I was appointed chief medical examiner for the county. And as I mentioned earlier, I was in that position up until 2017. And I'm board certified in anatomic pathology, which I mentioned before is general pathology in a sense. Also neuropathology, as I mentioned about the brain and spinal cord primarily. And then finally, forensic pathology.
In other words, Dr. Sheridan, you're triple board certified, is that correct?
I am, yes.
And that's in anatomic pathology, neuropathology, and forensic pathology.
That's correct, yes.
Can you describe any relevant teaching positions that you've held?
Yes.
Keep your voice up. I'm sorry, it's hard to hear back here.
Okay, I'm sorry. Yes, I still do some teaching, actually. First of all, I'm on the staff of the of Loma Linda University Medical Center, the place where I did my initial training. And I give lectures on a regular basis there to the pathology residents, like I used to be myself. Then in addition to that, for a long time, for about 20 years actually, up until COVID, I was also giving twice a year, courses on forensics at University of California Riverside Extension, as it's called. And I did that for, as I said, essentially 20 years, I think. But that stopped with COVID. So I haven't been doing that since the beginning of COVID epidemic. I've also given annual lectures, or not lectures, but courses, three-day courses, to the California Criminalistic Institute, which is part of the forensic system in California. And then in addition to that, I was associated with another university for a while, but that sort of gradually elapsed. And that's basically it. I give occasional lectures at, well, actually at least once a year at various other places, just individual lectures. I'm a visiting lecturer, in other words, and at community colleges and even high schools, actually. And then I forgot to mention one more thing. For two years, I was a visiting professor at a university in China, in what's called Hangzhou, H-A, I don't know if I pronounce it correctly even to this day, but Hangzhou, H-A-N-Z-H-O-U, whatever, H-O-U. It's a big city in China anyway, somewhere. And I was there for 2 years, two different years, I mean, giving courses on forensic pathology.
And Dr. Sheridan, are you a member of any academic or professional societies?
Of societies? Yes, I've been a member, although I've let it lapse recently intentionally, but I've been a member of the National Association of Medical Examiners for many years. I'm also a member of the American Academy for the Advancement of Science, and also the American Forensic Institute, or AAFS, American Academy of Forensic Science. I'm also a member of that.
And have you authored any peer reviewed articles or publications in the areas of forensic pathology or neuropathology?
Yes, but not recently. When I was working, it was too busy to publish. But yes, I did author a few papers earlier on in my career. One of which it wasn't really neuropathology, but it was urology more than, well, it was actually neuropharmacology. And then I did author another paper on, that was related to my forensic pathology work, on organ donation, organ and tissue donation for transplantation. Those are the two main ones, but there were a couple of other lesser papers.
Can you describe your duties as the chief medical examiner of San Bernardino County?
Yes, as chief medical examiner, I had some administrative responsibilities, fortunately not too many, because there were other people to do it. But most of my responsibility there was supervising the medical part of the coroner's office, in other words, the autopsy section. And I was supervising other pathologists, but I was also working full-time doing autopsies myself. So I spent most of my time actually performing autopsies. But I did have, as I said, administrative roles and the role of supervising colleagues. And of course, as a medical examiner, as a forensic pathologist, I frequently had to testify in court, rather like I'm doing now. So that was another part of my duty.
And during the course of your professional experience, approximately how many autopsies do you believe you've done?
It's between 12 and 13,000. I think it's closer to 13,000.
And have you qualified as an expert in the areas of forensicology, neurobiology, and anatomic?
In courts, yes. Yes, well over 400 times.
How many was that?
Over 400.
And did you review materials related to this case in furtherance of coming to an opinion and conclusion about Mr. O'Keefe's injuries?
Yes, I did. I reviewed quite a lot of materials.
What did you review?
Okay, I reviewed the autopsy report on this case. Along with that, it was the neuropathology report, which was separate. There was a toxicology report. There were autopsy photographs. These were all of primary importance to me, all these things. Then I also reviewed the complaint in this case, outlining, in other words, the basic details of the case. I reviewed photographs taken at the scene of death of Mr. O'Keefe, photographs of the vehicle that was allegedly involved in his death, photographs of the decedent himself before the autopsy while he was at the hospital, at Good Samaritan Hospital. Then there was also some videos of the scene of death. I also saw the death certificate, a document by CERT, S-E-R-T, police reports from Canton Police Department. Am I missing anything out? I don't think so. Yeah.
Your Honor, permission to publish what's been previously marked Exhibit 19.
Sure.
Dr. Sheridan, is this one of the photographs that you reviewed in reaching your opinions and conclusions case?
Yes, it is.
Can you describe the injuries that you see in this photograph?
These injuries that you're looking at here on the arm are abrasions, which are friction injuries, basically. We classify them under the general category of blunt force injury, but these particular ones are abrasions. Abrasions being where the outer layer of the skin, the epidermis as it's called, has been scraped off. These are friction injuries, essentially.
And based on your review of the information discussed earlier, can you tell, as well as your review of these photographs, can you tell whether these injuries were sustained before or after death?
These injuries were sustained before death. We call them ante-mortem, A-N-T-E, mortem meaning before death. And that's based primarily on their color. And you have to take other things into consideration, but that's the basics of it. If these had been post-mortem, they would have a more yellowish orange color, usually yellow.
In your professional opinion, based on a reasonable degree of scientific certainty, are those injuries consistent with being struck by a vehicle while holding a glass?
Objection.
May we approach, Your Honor?
Sure. I'm going to take this opportunity to ask you again to keep your voice up, please, sir.
I'm doing my best. My voice is not as strong as it used to be.
We are unmuted.
We'll stop the AC for a while, then. We'll stop the air conditioning for a while, then. We want to make sure we hear you.
Okay.
Dr. Sheridan, are these injuries consistent with a motor vehicle accident, in your opinion?
Sustained.
I would say in general, no. I
mean, so that objection was sustained. I think Ms. Little's going to put it to you in a different
way. I'm sorry.
If you could assume, for purposes of this question, that this individual was involved in a motor vehicle collision as a pedestrian, based on your review of his photographs, are those injuries consistent with having been struck by a...
Objection.
Sustained, why don't you come back?
You are unmuted.
Dr. Sheridan, how many autopsies have you conducted on individuals who are involved in pedestrian vehicle motor collisions?
Involved in pedestrian vehicles?
Yes.
Well over 100.
What other experience do you have in terms of conducting autopsies with individuals who have been involved in motor vehicle collisions?
Well, I mean, if you take motor vehicle accidents in general, they'd be probably nearly a quarter of my total number of autopsies. So, in other words, that'd be close to 3,000. Yeah, that's about right.
Based on your professional experience, what is your opinion regarding whether those injuries are consistent with a pedestrian being struck by a motor vehicle?
Objection.
I'm going to allow. You can answer that, Doctor. Mm-hmm. Can you answer that?
I can answer it, yes.
So right ahead.
Okay. Okay, the question was, to be precise, can you just rephrase it? I mean, I said yes, I can answer it, but I can't remember exactly how you phrased it.
Yes, based on your extensive training and experience, what is your opinion regarding whether those injuries are consistent with being struck, with an individual being struck by a vehicle?
If you mean struck in that part of the body, on the arm, like directly, I would say no, it doesn't look like that at all.
Mm-hmm. And can you explain that?
Well, if you're hit by a vehicle, whichever part of your body is hit, if it's a significant impact at all, you're going to get bruising. And we don't have any bruising here. We just have linear, what I would call linear abrasions, without any bruising. So that does not look to me at all remotely like an impact from a motor vehicle.
What would you expect to see if an individual's arm were struck by the rear of a motor vehicle?
Well, as I just said a second ago, primarily a lot of bruising, and that's what we don't see here. You might see, well, depending on the circumstances, you might see other things like a fracture or fractures, but you would at least expect bruising.
In your professional opinion, based on your many years of experience, have you conducted any autopsies involving individuals who were involved in any sort of animal attack?
Animal attacks in general, yes, quite a few, actually. Well, when I say quite a few, it's not an enormously common event, but I've done probably at least a dozen or so involving deaths where an animal was involved one way or another.
Have you conducted any autopsies in which any individual was attacked by a dog?
Yes, I have a few.
Can you describe that for the jury?
Well, I'd have to just refresh my memory out of the blue here. But first of all, I had a number of cases, three or four, I think, over the years involving children. It was primarily children who were killed by feral dogs. And the dogs attacked the kid, and killed them. So I had that a few times. But then I've also had cases where an animal, or a dog particularly, was involved, but wasn't the actual cause of death, so to speak, but they were involved in something that was happening and left some traces of their activity in the form of bite marks or scratch marks.
In your professional opinion, are those injuries consistent with an animal attack?
Are they consistent with what?
An animal attack.
I would say they are, yes. I'm not 100% sure about this, but my initial reaction when I saw this photograph was that it was probably an animal mark, and most likely I would say a dog. Scrape marks with the paws, and possibly also a bite mark from the teeth as well, possibly. I'm not 100% sure. I didn't get a chance to analyze it right there on the spot, so to speak. but my basic impression is that these were consistent with marks caused by, say, a dog using his paws or claws, if you want to put it that way, and possibly the teeth as well.
And if there's a pointer up there, would it be possible to direct the juries that you're referring to on the screen? There should be a little laser pointer there.
I don't know that I see one.
It's not there.
Oh. May I approach you?
Sure.
Okay.
Using the laser pointer, could you indicate the injuries that you believe just testified are consistent with scratch marks?
Actually, in a sense, they're all consistent with scratch marks in the sort of the more generic sense of their, whether it's the paws or the teeth, they're going across the skin rather than going straight into it. So they're all of these marks are generally consistent with, if you want to call them, scratch marks. So I don't know if this will work on the screen, but you basically got what looks like there's one pair there with possibly a third one in the middle. There are two very clear parallel marks there with another one fainter in the center. Then you have, going closer to the elbow, you've got another two or three, whichever way you look at that. At the elbow itself, you have, that's that part of the elbow there is what I would think is the most likely candidate here for a bite mark, because it has somewhat of something of the configuration of the outline of teeth. And then the ones on the forearm are a little bit less obvious, but they're still consistent in general with, I would say, claw marks or maybe from the teeth.
Dr. Sheridan, you assume that the decedent was standing with his arm extended in this manner, and he was struck with the rear taillight of a 7,000-pound Lexus only on the arm, such that it spun him around and propelled him 30 feet. Do you have an opinion as to whether or not these arm injuries are consistent with that scenario?
Objection.
All right, I'll see you later.
All rise for the court, please. Follow me, please.
So I'll see counsel. Are muted. Jimmy, I'll look at this.
One all rising.
You are unmuted.
All right, go right ahead, Ms. Little, in a loud voice.
Thank you. And Dr. Sheridan, I'll ask you to also just keep your voice down for this question.
I'll try.
Assume the decedent was standing with his arm outstretched like this and was struck by the rear of an SUV only in his arm at 24 miles per hour. Are the injuries in Exhibit 19 consistent in that scenario?
No, I do not think so.
Can you describe that?
Well, as I think I've already mentioned before, one thing that's not there, that should be there, given that idea, that scenario, is there should be bruising, at least bruising, if not perhaps even more than that, but bruising for sure. Secondly, the appearance of these injuries, their pattern, if you want to just call it that, the way they're distributed doesn't seem to fit the idea of the rear of a vehicle being the impacting object.
And at 24 miles per hour, would you expect to see fractures or breaks in the arm?
You could do. There'd be other factors involved as to pending. It would depend on a lot of things, but it's possible, yeah.
I'd like to direct your attention to the injury that Mr. O sustained to his head. Do you recall that injury?
To the head? Yes. Mm-hmm.
Could you describe that injury for the jury?
Well, there were a few minor injuries on the face, but the major injury, and indeed the main cause of death, was an impact to the back of the head, slightly to the right of the midline of the back of the head, and where there was a laceration. A laceration is another type of blunt force trauma, but this is a laceration is where the skin is actually opened up or it's split, so you get bleeding from a laceration. So there was a laceration, as I said, in the back of the scalp, in what's called the occipital area. And beneath that, when the skin was moved away as part of the autopsy, there was extensive bruising, hemorrhage in other words, in the scalp at that same point. There was a fracture that started at that point in the skull, but traveled all the way forward to the frontal areas of the skull. So you have the impact site is clear because, as I said, you've got the laceration, that's where the impact was. So you have the impact with the scalp hemorrhage there and the skull fractures. Then the brain itself had injuries, significant injuries. First of all, there was bleeding on the surface of the brain, and that's very common in situations like this. But in addition to that, there were extensive bruises, contusions is the real word actually, but they are essentially bruises of the brain substance itself. And that they were in several different parts of the brain, including the frontal areas, which are near the forehead, and also the temporal, which are towards the side, more or less. And then there was also hemorrhage deep inside the brain in the ventricles, which are open areas in the center of the brain. All of these things were described in the neuropathology report, and you can see them in the photographs that were part of the neuropathology report as well as the autopsy. As a result of the injury to the brain began to swell, and that's what it usually does after major trauma. And as a result of the swelling, you had what's called herniation, where the brain, if you want to think of it this way, the brain is trying to expand, but it can't because the skull is around it. So it begins to put pressure, pushing, especially downwards towards the top of the spinal cord. And eventually, as happened in this case, it's quite clear from the photographs, the brain herniated downwards, the brainstem particularly herniated downwards, and this would have been the final straw, so to speak. That's what would lead to respiratory failure and death. So this was a fatal injury for certain.
And what impact would that type of injury have had on the individual after sustaining it?
You know, once this impact occurred, Mr. O'Keefe would have been unconscious. He would still be capable of breathing for a while until that brain swelling took over and pushed the brainstem down. But he would immediately from the point of impact, he would have been unconscious for sure.
He had been able to stand up, move, or walk?
No, he would have been unconscious completely.
Do you have any opinion regarding whether that injury is consistent with having been struck on the ground on dirt or grass?
I'm sorry, you didn't quite get the question.
I'll rephrase it. That was a poorly worded question. Is that injury consistent with striking dirt or grass?
Like, for example, falling onto grass?
Yes.
No, I don't think so. If there's a fall involved here, and there could be, it would be onto a hard surface. But the grass, and as I understand from all the material I reviewed, there was also some snow, and so that might even cushion the impact even a little bit more. But even without the snow, grass is basically too soft for somebody falling and hitting their head on it to get the injuries I've just described.
In addition to focusing on the injuries that were present, what significance do you place on the absence of injuries in conducting an autopsy?
What significance do I place on what?
In addition to focusing on the injuries that are present, what significance do you place on the absence of injuries when conducting an autopsy?
Well, as you put it there, it's a rather general question, but I mean, when you're doing an autopsy, you obviously want to see what is there and what's not, and everything can be relevant, including absent things. Now, in this particular case, there are a number of features of things that are absent that are important. I've already alluded to one, and that is on the arm. If that was an impact from the vehicle, I would expect bruising. But do you want me to continue?
Yes. Yeah.
But if Mr. O'Keefe was struck with, it depends obviously what part of the body is theoretically involved. But if the body, if a vehicle hits you, whether it's the back of the vehicle or the front, you're going to have, and if, as long as it's not going extremely slowly, if it's going at any speed at all, any significant speed, it's going to cause at least bruising. And that there was this particular case, one of the things that struck me was that there was a distinct absence of bruising on the torso, the chest, abdomen, hips, whatever. And also, in most cases that I've ever been involved in where a pedestrian was hit by a vehicle, there are injuries on the legs, including fractures, which are very common on the legs. So the absence of all of these things in this case, I think, is important.
Have you conducted autopsies involving individuals who were involved in fights or altercations?
Yes, many, many times.
Approximately how many?
Gosh, I have no idea. And it's been a lot. I mean, I've done, I said earlier that between, well, over 12, maybe 13,000 total autopsies. Of those, I'm only giving you estimates here, but over 1,000 would have been homicides. Of those, probably maybe a fifth, or about 200, would have involved blunt force trauma instead of, for example, a firearm or something like that. And in those cases, and of course, yeah, okay, so all of those and other cases involving sharp force, homicides involving sharp force may have elements, evidence of a struggle as well. So it's in the hundreds, yeah.
In your expert medical opinion, are Mr. O'Keefe's injuries consistent with a fight or a physical altercation?
In a general sense, they can be. They could be, yes. He had, I alluded to it just briefly before, but the head injury, the major head injury I've described, but he also had a laceration over his right eyelid. He had some scrape marks on his face. He also had some bruises on the back of his right hand, which that kind of injury on the hands can be what we call a defensive injury. In other words, an injury that occurs when you're protecting yourself and you're hit in the hit either with another fist or with a hard object, and you're protecting yourself. So I would say that some of these findings I've just mentioned are consistent with the possibility of a physical altercation, yes.
Thank you. If I could have one more.
Sure.
No further questions.
Okay, just to ask.
Morning, Doctor.
Morning.
Injuries that you were just testifying about regarding Mr. O'Keefe, they were on his right knee, his right arm, as well as the back right side of his head. Is that correct?
Yes, I forgot to mention the knee, but yes, there were injuries in those places, yes.
And understandable, but this isn't an autopsy you performed yourself, correct?
I did not perform myself, no.
You never saw the body, you're looking at photographs and report, correct?
Yeah, I'm going by the photographs and the autopsy report, yes.
And contained within the materials that you reviewed, did you ever look at Mr. O'Keefe's medical record in the Good Samaritan?
Look at whose medical records, Mr. O'Keefe's?
Yes.
I looked at the medical records from Good Samaritan Hospital where he was pronounced dead, yes.
You did look at those as well?
I did look at those, yeah. I thought I mentioned it earlier. Maybe I forgot.
Now, with regard to what you reviewed of Mr. O'Keefe's injuries, you saw no injuries to his left arm, correct?
To his left arm? No, I don't think so. No.
No injuries to his left leg, correct?
No.
Torso that you saw?
That's correct.
Mm-hmm. And no injuries to the back left side of his head, is that correct? Well,
that's correct, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, you indicated that you observed or reviewed the autopsy report, as well as autopsy photographs and the death record.
I did, yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you agree with Dr. Scortibello's determination as to the cause of death being multiple blunt force type injuries in conjunction with hypothermia?
I do agree with her, yes.
Mm-hmm. And you reviewed also the neuropathology report by Dr. Stonebridge?
I did, yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you agree or concur with finding Dr. Stonebridge contained within that report?
Yes, there were photographs taken during the neuropathology examination, which were independent confirmation for me of the things described in the report. Yes.
Now, with regard to autopsies that you formed in the past, well, let me ask you this first: as far as the injuries that you observed in the photographs to Mr. O'Keefe's right arm, they were not the cause of Mr. O'Keefe, correct?
No, they were not. Mm-hmm.
With regard to autopsies that you formed in the past, in regard to there being some sort of animal involved in testifying for, is it normal to see just injuries related to an animal attack on just one portion of one piece of the body?
Yes, in a general way. I mean, as I mentioned, I think when I was answering the question about the cases I've done involving animals, I tried to divide them into two groups because there's an important difference. Some of those cases were cases where the animals were responsible for the death itself. As I said, a bunch of feral dogs in one case particularly that I remember. Another was a case where it wasn't a whole bunch of them, but there were two dogs, large dogs, and they killed the victims, children. So those individuals had multiple injuries, including deep bite marks that were fatal, particularly in the neck area. But they also had, and I'm stretching my memory a bit because it's a while since I did these cases, but I do have a general recollection that in at least those cases, in addition to the fatal injuries, there were also some non-fatal sort of things like paw marks. And I can't remember the distribution, though, on the body.
Can you remember as far as whether or not these injuries that you observed and not the child fatalities with the dog's maul, I'm presuming that those involved injuries to significant and extensive parts of the body. Is that correct?
Yeah, those are the ones where the animals caused the death, yes.
So in the other instances that you were talking about, all even whether or not those injuries that you observed were anti-mortem or post-mortem?
I'm sorry, I couldn't hear the last part.
The other ones that you were talking about as far as the other animal attacks that you've seen, yeah. Do you recall whether or not the injuries that you observed in those instances were anti-mortem or post-mortem?
Oh, anti-mortem. Well, actually, in one of the cases that comes to mind, the marks appeared to be post-mortem, and that was... this person was actually a homicide victim, and they were lying outdoors, and their own dog, this was according to police, though, who came on the scene. When they arrived, there was a dog that turned out to be the victim's own dog, was pawing at the body, and the person was dead. But in another case that I can think of, the scratch marks from dog paws were anti-mortem, and they were confined to one place only. I'm trying to remember what part of the body. This case, I had to testify later on. This case that I'm thinking of now, the paw marks were limited to just one location. I can't remember exactly where they were, though, whether it was the leg or the arm. I can't remember.
And that was post-mortem injuries you're talking about there, correct?
No, in the second case here, they were anti-mortem. So in other words, there's been post-mortem and anti-mortem, yes.
The injuries that you observed on Mr. O'Keefe's arm were to the posterior part of his arm, correct?
Yes, basically, posterior.
No injuries that you observed on the anterior portion or the other side of right arm, correct?
That's correct, yes.
No other injuries that you observed consistent with what you're talking about as far as an animal attack on any other part of Mr. O'Keefe's body, correct?
That's correct, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And from what you observed in the reports and the photographs, you can't say definitively what type of animal, correct?
That's correct, I can't.
And you can't say even if it was an animal or was a dog, what breed of dog that was, is that correct?
No, but if I had to try, and if I said...
I'm not asking you to try, sir. I'm just asking whether or not you'd say whether or not that, what breed of dog it was.
No, I can't tell you what breed, no.
You can't say whether or not those injuries were inflicted inside a house or outside of a house, is that correct?
Yeah, I have no idea. Mm-hmm.
You can't say when they occurred, correct?
Only that they were when he was still alive, yeah. But other than that, no. And they are fresh looking. I mean, in this generally, so they look like that they happened very shortly before death.
And when you say short time, you're talking about hours?
Minutes to hours, I would say.
Minutes to hours, but you can't...
I mean, I'm talking just based on the injuries themselves alone, leaving anything else out. You can't time injuries as exactly as you might think from CSI or one of these television programs, but they are generally fresh for sure. And but just looking at those on their own, I would have to say minutes to hours, yes.
Now, at some point, were you given or did you review any files from a lab at the University of California, Davis?
I'm not sure. In relation to what?
So are you aware that the State Police Lab in Massachusetts swabbed areas of the sleeve on the right arm of Mr. O'Keefe and sent samples from that in the areas of where the injury occurred on his right arm and then sent that to a lab at UC Davis? Are you aware of that?
I'm not sure that I remember that, no.
And so you're equally unaware then that when that was tested, there was no canine DNA found from any of those swabbings in the area where the injuries that you're describing as scratch marks or bite marks hurt?
I wasn't aware of that. I must have missed it.
Are you aware of any sort of bite history or a specific animal at 34 Fairview being involved in attacks on other dogs?
I'm sorry, I don't think I understood that question.
Were you aware that there was a dog that resided at 34 Fairview Road?
Am I aware that there was a dog there?
Yes.
I was informed there was, yes.
Were you also informed that dog, months later, after January 2022, involved in an incident in which it attacked another dog, humans intervened, and one of the humans was bit?
No, I didn't know that.
Were you aware that there were photographs of an actual bite mark from that actual dog months after January 29th? Were you shown any of that?
No, I don't believe I was.
Now, sir, did you write a report in relation to what you observed or anything in regard to your opinion or your testimony that you're testifying to here today?
I didn't write a report as such, but I signed a declaration early on in my involvement in this case.
And that was a declaration or an affidavit that you signed under penalties of perjury back on January 31st, 2023, is that correct?
Sorry, I apologize about that.
When you're talking about a declaration, you're referring to an affidavit that you filed with court under pains and penalties of perjury in January of 2023.
I didn't think it was January, but however, I thought there was only one, so whatever you have.
Now, at any point in time, were you made aware that there were microscopic pieces of the defendant's taillight, as small as 1/16 of an inch by 1/16 of an inch, that were found in Mr. O'Keefe's clothing?
Objection.
I'll allow it.
That were found in Mr. O'Keefe's what?
Mr. O'Keefe's shirt.
I don't remember that specifically.
And that those pieces were then found to be consistent with the defendant's taillight.
Like I said, I don't remember that particular part.
Were you ever shown any material indicating that there was DNA from the defendant's taillight housing that was consistent with Mr. O'Keefe?
I asked about that myself, but I think the answer I got was no.
Now, were you ever told about a piece of human hair that was found on the right rear quarter panel near the area where there was a dent on the back right of the defendant's vehicle?
No, I don't remember that.
But then you weren't also told that that was then sent out for mitochondrial DNA testing, and it was consistent with that of Mr. O'Keefe to a degree of 99.895%.
You're talking about a hair sample now. Yeah. No, I didn't have that.
Now, Doctor, would you agree that in blunt impact injuries, the characteristics of a blunt object can then be transferred to the victim in the form of pattern abrasions that match characteristics of that blunt object?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Now, of the photographs, you reviewed photographs of the scene, photographs of the vehicle, is that correct?
Yes, I did.
You're aware that there were a number of different pieces of the defendant's taillight that were photographed as well. Did you ever see those?
I did, yes. Mm-hmm.
Do you recall seeing any piece of a clear plastic taillight piece that was recovered on January 29th, along with Mr. O's sneaker that had dimpling on the outside of that clear piece of plastic?
I remember seeing the pictures of the glass fragments, but I don't remember any more specifics than that.
Do you know what a compression abrasion is?
What?
Compression abrasion.
Yeah, although it's not a term we use all the time, but however, yes.
And a compression abrasion can occur when there's direct pressure from a blunt object together with slight rubbing movements that produce skin and epidermal, crushing. Is that correct?
Yeah, you have to have some lateral movement as well, though, to get an abrasion.
Now, when you were talking about prior autopsies that you've done involving pedestrian collisions, is it fair to say that most of those pedestrian collisions that you were doing autopsies on involved pedestrians being struck by the front of the vehicle?
Yeah, mostly the front. Mm-hmm. So
mostly it's a pedestrian sort of crossing the street or standing in the street and then struck by the front of the vehicle, correct?
Yeah, I think they were all. I have actually done a couple of cases where children were hit by the back of a reversing vehicle. This was in the days before they had rear videos on cars that they have now. But so those cases were impacts against the back of the vehicle. But most pedestrian cases are, as you say, the front of the vehicle hitting the person.
Just briefly on that, as far as the defendant's vehicle itself, are you aware that there were rear backup cameras and a 360-degree overhead view from the back of her vehicle?
I remember reading that, Jess.
Now, understanding what you're talking about as far as a rear vehicle pedestrian collision, is that typically sort of the wear on the vehicle? Let me ask you, when you are doing an autopsy in relation to a pedestrian collision, much of the information that you're gaining about that is what you receive from the investigating agency, whether it's the police or something like that, correct?
It varies a lot from one case to another. Sometimes you get no, or virtually no information about the accident. Because some of these cases I've done, some of them were witnessed, some weren't, let's put it that way. Yeah. So when they weren't witnessed and when the person was just found later or sometime afterwards, you wouldn't have necessarily any, the vehicle would typically not be there. These would be hit and run type situations. And so in those cases, you wouldn't have all that kind of information. So it varies.
And understanding that it varies, but primarily what I'm saying is whatever information as far as the body comes in and you're going to conduct an autopsy, there would be some information from law enforcement or witness statements or something as to what type of death this is, as far as gunshot wound, stabbing, pedestrian collision, something like
that. Yeah, absolutely. But like I said, in those unwitness cases of pedestrians, I might be given the information that it's probably a pedestrian fatality from a car.
And when it comes to pedestrian collisions, and most of which that you've seen are, again, from the front of the vehicle striking a pedestrian in the roadway, is that correct?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And are you familiar with what role sort of the center of mass of that person versus the center of mass of where they're struck plays in reference to their injuries?
Yeah, that can have a big effect on how the body reacts to the impact.
Mm-hmm. So most of the time when you're talking about sort of lower extremity injuries or pelvic fractures or things like that, that's in a frontal collision with the pedestrian, correct?
Most of them were, yeah. I mean, the ones that involved being backed over, and they were children. I can't remember the exact distribution of their injuries, except the vehicle went right over them. I do remember that. But anyway, the answer to your question, maybe I'm wandering in my mind, so can you ask me again?
I think you've answered it. So my next question, sir, is when it comes to the rear-end collisions, primarily being children, you would agree with me that they have a lower center of mass than a 6'1", 200-something?
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so as far as them being run over, they're going to get struck, they're probably going to fall to the ground, and then the vehicle is going to go over.
That's right, yeah.
And so how many autopsies have you conducted in regard to pedestrian collisions where they've been sideswiped by the back of it?
I can't remember.
Can you remember any?
Not off the top of my head, no. Mm-hmm.
And so if someone is struck by the right rear portion of a vehicle and then projected away from the vehicle based on speed, based on force, based on whatever, would you then expect to see those same type of pelvic fractures or lower extremity injuries that you talked about with a frontal collision?
Well, it depends on the exact position of the victim in at the moment of impact. And of course, it could be a lot of different things. They could be, the victim could be facing the vehicle, they could be sideways on, they could have their back. But you're going to see bruising somewhere in that area, in one of those areas, either on the back, the side, whatever, or the front. I would expect to see bruising, significant bruising.
But as you testified earlier on direct, it's sort of dependent or variable depending on how the victim pedestrian interacted with the vehicle. Isn't that correct?
Yes, but I'd expect bruising for sure. I mean, whether you get fractures and so forth will depend on, or for that matter, internal injuries depends on a variety of factors. But you're going to get bruising for sure.
Now, you did see bruising on Mr. O'Keefe's right hand, correct?
Yes, a small bruising. It looked like two, possibly three, almost confluent or close together bruises.
Were you aware from the materials that you reviewed that Mr. O'Keefe was last seen sort of on video exiting from a bar at about 12:11 a.m. holding a cocktail glass in his right hand?
I vaguely remember that, yes.
Were you also aware that there were pieces of a cocktail glass with Mr. O'Keefe's DNA on it that were found right in the general vicinity of where his body was found?
That I don't remember. Mm-hmm.
You talked about a couple of different patterns, the injuries that you observed on Mr. O'Keefe's right arm. So my question for you, doctor, is it your testimony that those, what you're terming as animal bites or scratches, were they caused at one time or multiple times, or how many times are we talking?
You mean on different occasions?
Yeah, as far as in, there are multiple abrasions, as you've termed them, and you're attributing them to an animal attack, correct?
I think that's the most likely explanation for these, yes.
And so my question is, sir, is that from the dog or the animal or whatever it is, scratching Mr. O'Keefe once, more than once, based on what you observed in
Well, it's more than once. When I had the laser pointer here, I think I pointed to roughly, what, 1, 2, 3, 4 different areas. So it looks like, and you have, maybe there's an additional, the ones on the lower forearm, on the forearm, I should say, are harder to figure out. But it looks like 4, maybe 5 separate.
4 or 5 separate sort of swipes, whether they be with mouth or claws or whatever.
Yeah, that's correct.
And so is it your testimony that it's not possible that Mr. O'Keefe received that from some part of the motor vehicle or a glass shattering or shattering from a taillight or any sort of metal pieces underneath contained within that taillight housing as far as his interaction with the vehicle?
They don't look remotely like that to me.
So it's not possible, is that correct?
In my opinion, no.
You were asked about some questions with regard regard to the surface of the ground, as far as dirt or grass. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with what the weather was like at the time that Mr. O'Keefe, you testified earlier, you were familiar that he was found in the snow, correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Do you know what the temperature was like as far as, my question is this. Understanding cushioning of grass and dirt under normal conditions, but if the ground is physically frozen based on the temperature of outside, would that impact as far as your understanding of the injuries to the back of Mr. O'Keefe?
No, I mean, even if there was a small coating of ice, I wouldn't change my opinion based on that, no.
I'm not talking about ice, sir. What I'm talking about is ground itself being physically frozen based on the temperatures outside.
Objection.
Now, as far as the hard surface that you're talking about, would that include asphalt pavement?
Yes, it could.
Mm-hmm. And as far as those injuries, the speed, if Mr. O'Keefe was struck by a vehicle and was projected away from that vehicle and then struck his head on the ground, would that sufficient force, in your opinion, to cause the skull fracture on the back of his head?
If all that happened, yes. And onto asphalt or something like asphalt, yes. If that's indeed what happened. But like for other reasons, I don't think that is what happened.
Now, you testified or you asked some questions about your opinion and as to or consistency with physical altercation, is that right?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the sort of swelling in Mr. O'Keefe's eyes as far as the ecchymosis concerned there, that was related to the brain injury, is that your understanding?
Well, the skull injury rather than the brain.
Skull injury, which leads to the bleeding of the brain, which then leads to the swelling of the eyes.
Well, yeah, but no, I mean, let's be clear about this. I mentioned the fractures earlier on that came from the back and went all the way towards the front of the skull, including what are called the orbital plates, which are the bones, the parts of the frontal bone that are right over the eye sockets. And the bone there is very delicate. It's the thinnest part of the skull. Anyway, the photographs and the autopsy report clearly show that the fracture involved that on each side, both orbital plates, in other words. And it's that fracture, it's not the brain itself, but it's that fracture which leads to the bleeding that causes the black eyes, if you want to call them that way.
And as far as what your review of the medical record, review of the autopsy report, photographs, things of that, you observed nothing as far as fractures to Mr. O'Keefe's eye sockets, correct?
Well, the orbital plates, in a sense, are part of the eye sockets, so they're the roof.
Were there any fractures to the orbital bone?
There were no fractures that appeared to be coming from the front, no.
As far as the sclera, was there any broken blood vessels or anything that you observed in either the notes or reports or photographs or anything else?
Broken blood vessels were?
The sclera.
Huh?
Sclera of the eyes, you know what that is?
Oh, the eye, yeah. I'm sorry, I couldn't hear. Just couldn't hear what you said, yeah. No, there was. Just, as far as I know, the eyes were clear, yeah. The eyes themselves were clear, yeah.
Now, as far as the minor injuries that you were talking about, as far as the eyelid or the nose, as far as the minor lacerations you were talking about, there was no bruising around any of those lacerations, correct?
The eyelid laceration, don't forget, is in the same area where you have the other injury, and it's a little bit hard to figure out whether how much hemorrhage, how much of that black eye could even be from related to the laceration, because you've got two possible explanations for the black eyes. One is the skull fracture I've already mentioned, but that doesn't rule out his getting an impact as well on the front, but there's no way you can separate them.
But as far as around those minor lacerations talking about, you didn't observe or see any record of any bruising or any broken bones in those areas whatsoever?
No, the main one that I was relating to when I spoke about the altercation question was the laceration on the eyelid. That's not related to the head injury that we've been discussing. So it's a separate injury, and it's from some kind of blow to the front.
Minor lacerations that you observe, would they be consistent with being struck by broken pieces of glass or broken sharp pieces of plastic?
If it was indeed a laceration, as it was described, then no, because lacerations by definition, although this is a term that's often misused, by the way, even by some doctors, but a laceration by definition is an open wound caused by blunt force, not sharp.
So blunt force, as far as what I'm asking, is possible that the lacerations to his face were caused by a blunt object that then shattered and caused the laceration.
I find that hard to imagine. I find that very hard to even conceive of.
So it's not conceivable, is that what you're saying?
To me, no.
And from your review of whatever reports and medical records and everything else, What, if anything, did you see, or did you see anything that had to do with an animal being present on scene, or an animal being near Mr. O'Keefe's body, or Mr. O'Keefe being inside the house?
I don't know. I mean, but I heard there was an animal somewhere around the place, a dog. I think you mentioned the dog earlier.
So somewhere around the place, but no evidence that you've seen that an animal interacted with Mr. O'Keefe in any way?
No, I wasn't there, obviously, and all I can say is what I've already said, but I don't know any more than that.
I know you weren't there. What I'm saying is, from the material that you review, was there any indication or any evidence of that animal ever being near, close to, or interacting in any way with Mr. O'Keefe?
Not that I'm aware of, no.
I love the process.
Little? Thank you. Your Honor, if I may approach.
Sure.
Thank you.
So, Ms. Tulalli?
Dr. Sheridan, if you could just take a look at that photograph. Do you recognize that?
Yes, I saw this photograph before. Yeah.
Can you describe that photograph, Jerry?
It shows the decedent's knees taken from the right side, but you can see both knees.
Your Honor, permission to mark this and then publish it.
Mark it and put it into evidence? Okay, is there any objection, Mr. Lally?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. That would be Exhibit 657.
Yes, you may push it. Dr. Shannon, you were asked on cross-examination about injury to Mr. Oak's knee. Do you recall that testimony?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Is this the injury that you were testifying about earlier?
Yes, this has been mentioned before. It's an abrasion.
And that's the event injury to Mr. O'Keefe's right?
Yeah, that's it, yeah, in that area. Yeah.
Thank you. No further questions.
All right, Dr. Sheridan, you are all set, sir.
Very well, thank you very much.
Thank you,
Your Honor.
Step right up and walk up on me. Stay in the face.
You saw this with the evidence given to the court and jury in the case now in hearing for the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, so help God.
Yes.
All right, Mr. Jackson, whenever you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. Doctor, could you state your full name and spell your last name for us, please?
Daniel Michael Wolfe, last name spelled W-O-L-F-E.
Dr. Wolfe, what do you do for a living?
I am the director of accident reconstruction at a company known as ARCA, A-R-C-C-A.
And what is ARCA exactly?
So ARCA is a forensic engineering consulting firm. We have a variety of disciplines that include human factors, biomechanics, crashworthiness, accident reconstruction, just to name a few.
What, based on your title, it sounds like you're the director of the entire accident reconstruction format for ARCA, correct?
That is correct.
What sort of contracts does ARCA routinely engage in?
So we do a lot of work in civil litigation. So we work with insurance carriers, law firms, but we also consult with and do projects with the federal government, as well as the National Hockey League on player safety. So we're involved in a number of research projects as well.
Is there other clientele that seeks out ARCA for accident reconstruction or biomechanics or human factors issues?
In terms of beyond the parties that I just listed?
You mentioned the U.S. Department of Defense?
Yes, the military, yes, the Army.
Tell me a little bit about the work that you've done for the Department of Defense.
Well, that was before my time, but I'm aware of projects that dealt with working on vehicles that were over in the Middle East, where they basically designed energy-absorbing seats because there was injuries when the vehicles were going over IEDs.
Is ARCA known both nationally and internationally? Is it recognized as a leader in accident reconstruction issues?
Yes.
As the director of accident reconstruction at ARCA, do you specialize in both accident reconstruction and the human factors that are associated with such reconstruction where necessary?
Yes.
Can you give me a synopsis of the professional discipline of what is accident reconstruction?
I think a simple definition in my mind would be the application of physics, engineering science, and mathematics to collision events. I always like to think of it as if you open up a puzzle box and you dump the pieces out and you've got a bunch of pieces and you're trying to piece together the evidence to see how everything fits to get a clear picture.
And what is the application of human factors to that process?
So to give you an example of human factors in the field of accident reconstruction, so I do a lot of nighttime visibility and conspicuity work. So to give you an example of that, let's say a driver's driving down the road at night. There's a pedestrian that's crossing the road. So we want to have an understanding based upon that pedestrian's clothing, the headlights of the vehicle, any potential artificial lighting in the area. When does a driver recognize that individual in the roadway? And then we can also look at literature to have an understanding of how do drivers respond based upon the hazard they're presented with. So there's different response times depending on the hazard. So it's going to be different for a pedestrian crossing the roadway or a driver responding to a vehicle suddenly stopped. stopping in front of them.
Dr. Wolf, as an accident reconstructionist, do you investigate and reconstruct both passenger vehicle issues, commercial vehicle issues, motor vehicle, pedestrian issues, all of the above?
Yes, I see all types of accidents.
And how long have you been doing this work with ARCA?
A little over 7 years now.
What education, training, and background qualifies you to perform the duties that you've just described for the jury?
Back in 2012, I received a Bachelor of Science in Engineering from James Madison University, along with a minor in mathematics. Some of my courses while at JMU included courses in physics, statics, dynamics, kinematics, material science, along with your other engineering sciences. Subsequent to my undergraduate degree, I then went on to the University of Delaware to pursue my PhD in electrical and computer engineering with a concentration in electromagnetics and photonics.
What additional training or experience do you have as it relates to accident reconstruction in addition to the formal education and the PhD?
Certainly. So in addition to my undergraduate degree and my PhD, I've continued to take courses through Northwestern University in crash reconstruction. Some of those courses have included human factors, lighting. I've taken courses on electronic vehicle data, photogrammetry, three-dimensional laser scanning. So I've continued to take courses subsequent to graduating.
Do you also hold any accreditations in terms of accident reconstruction?
Yes, I'm accredited by an organization known as ACTAR, which is the Accreditation Commission for Traffic Accident Reconstruction.
Are you trained in photogrammetry?
Yes, sir.
Is that to determine vehicle crash incidents or the circumstances surrounding them based on map scenes, evidence photographs, things of that nature?
Absolutely. So photogrammetry is the science of extracting information, if you will, out of photographs. So things dimensionally about an object, spatially, without ever actually physically seeing the object or inspecting it.
So you don't have to be at the scene to effectively and scientifically reconstruct it to your satisfaction?
No, not at all. And quite frankly, to be honest with you, in my world in civil litigation, oftentimes by the time a case comes across my desk, it's, you know, the accident happened 5 years ago. Some I've even had 10 or 15 years ago. So getting access to the vehicle at that point, it's going to be a long shot.
Doctor, are you a member of any professional societies?
Yes.
Describe those.
So I'm a member of the Society of Automotive Engineers, SAE. I'm also a member of the National Association for Professional Accident Reconstructionists, the Optical Society of America, and also the Illuminating Engineering Society.
How many cases would you say in your experience in your career have you reconstructed or attempted to reconstruct, you or your team members?
I don't actively track that. If I had to estimate at this point in my career, I'd probably be well over 1,000.
And how many of those 1,000, I know you'd have a number specific, but how many of those 1,000 would you say involved pedestrians as well?
Several hundred. As I mentioned earlier, a great deal of my work is in the field of lighting and visibility. So there's a direct correlation between time of day and pedestrian incidents. We see a rise in the evening and night hours just due to drivers having a difficult ability to try to perceive and recognize individuals. So I certainly see a lot of pedestrian collisions in my casework.
Done testing or research as it relates to kinematics and the interaction between pedestrians and vehicles?
Absolutely. So we do a number of tests at ARCA to look at the interaction between pedestrians and vehicles. One of the ones I know I did most recently where we were evaluating a vehicle essentially rolling over a pedestrian. So we wanted to understand the vehicle dynamics as well as the interaction between the pedestrian and the road surface. So we conducted testing at ARCA to evaluate that.
Does ARCA have any other disciplines other than just accident reconstruction?
Absolutely. So as I mentioned earlier, we have crashworthiness. So again, that's where you're going to be looking at the safety of a vehicle. How does it perform in a crash? We have human factors, failure analysis, premise liability, and biomechanics.
As an accident reconstructionist, doctor, do you or have you studied or tested the forces that are at play between objects interacting, a human being interacting with a vehicle, for instance?
Yeah, absolutely.
Part of what you do.
Yes, sir.
Describe that.
So we use hybrid instrumented dummies at ARCA for our testing. So we want to have an understanding that an occupant in a vehicle, the forces that they might experience, or for any matter, again, if it's an instance where you have something that ends up falling on someone's head and you want to have an understanding of the forces involved in that, we perform testing with hybrid dummies.
Have you ever authored any peer-reviewed papers in the field of physics?
Yes, sir.
Describe those.
So I have a number of papers in the field of lighting and optics. I have a recent publication that deals with Toyota and Lexus vehicle control history records as well.
Is that called Toyota Vehicle Control History, Sudden Braking History Recording Characteristics?
Yes, sir.
Was that specific to dealing with vehicles and their interaction with other vehicles and or pedestrians?
It involved looking at the various triggers that system is capable of recording. And specifically, it was looking at what triggers a sudden braking event. So we were able to determine that those triggers, the sudden braking event, is triggered when a driver, or I should say the vehicle,
Jackson,
reaches...
May we approach?
Sure.
More raw courtroom coverage of the trial of Karen Reed is coming up from True Crime Today and the Hidden Killers podcast. Press subscribe so you don't miss a minute.
Extra Value Meals are back. That means 10 tender juicy McNuggets and medium fries and a drink are just $8. Only at McDonald's.
For limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. Prices may be higher in Hawaii, Alaska, and California, and for delivery.